Golf Smarter, number 388, published on June 11, 2013, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
That putt was supposed to break to the left. Vector Putting with John Grund.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, John.
Oh, thanks, Fred. Good to be here.
And thank you so much for coming into the studio to have this conversation, because it would have been just as easy to go walking around on the golf course, but it's...
Well.
Not today, because there's people out there playing.
Okay.
And we could probably, maybe we'll do some video out there at some point.
That'd be great.
We'll
look
do some Golf
That'd
Smarter.
Be awesome.
Yeah, some video tips there. But I wanted to bring you in, and the reason I asked you to come in today is because I had mentioned recently that you had taken me aside and given me some lessons on vector putting. Mm-hmm. And we had done a lot recently about aim point putting. And when I told you about that, you said, no, I got to show you this. You got all excited about wanting to show me this. So that's really where I want to talk about today is the putting. But there's so many other topics that are so hot right now that I don't know if I want to do this now or we'll get into it later. But I think everyone's like, no, I don't want to know about the news. Let's talk about putting. So explain to me, is it called vector putting? Is that how we can refer to it and everyone would know what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
There was a colonel in the Air Force. I believe his name was Mr. Templeton, Colonel Templeton. And he was also a very, very bright man, as often the case with some of those gentlemen. He was one of the early pioneers in NASA flying, I believe, planes at higher elevations at supersonic speeds.
Okay.
And was involved in that process on many levels. Also an avid golfer, and upon retirement discovered, people just, if you look at the numbers, 36 putts is an acceptable amount, and your par 72, gosh, that's 50% of the game.
Yes, it is.
If we go by what, is allowable in golf, right? And 36 putts, et cetera, 14 tee shots. And he thought people do this pretty badly. Why? And one of the things he thought was, people just don't read greens very effectively. So he felt that based on his mathematical background and probably trying to figure out how a spaceship is going to go from one place to another and the amount of time it's going to take, the amount of friction involved, all the things that are involved in space travel and travel in general, what about a golf ball traveling across a green?
Hmm.
Couldn't there be some mathematical equation to that?
And that's not very dissimilar to what aim point.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how this all pans out in the world, but I think there's a lot of similarities on the mathematical side. I can't speak for aim point, but my guessing is there's probably a lot of similarities on the science side of aim point and vector green reading. And I think both are fine. The important thing that I've learned as an instructor is to be functional. And I want my students and the people that come to me, and not only them, but myself, because I'm usually my biggest guinea pig, is what are the things that make us better? What are the things that we're involved in? And both aim point and vector green reading do this. The vector I found was more functional in that it simplified things dramatically and gave a clearer picture of application for the individual to apply and move forward in his game and be involved in some basic fundamental areas, which all good putters are when they're involved in the process of putting effectively.
You and I spent half hour
right
on a putting green at best. I mean, you just wanted to show it to me, and I was trying to absorb as much as I possibly could. But I got to tell you, the impact that it had on my next few rounds was significant.
Right.
And I don't want to just say then I forgot and it's all done. Right. I'm still incorporating it into every green I walk on, but I definitely saw huge improvement immediately.
Great. That's what I love to hear.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, is it that simple?
You know,
because if I got it, it's got to be simple.
Fred, I always enjoy sitting talking with you, but now that I'm in your lair, so to speak, in your studio, I notice your vast book collection, and I just set down a book where a very famous instructor said that Matt Kuchar in five swings picked up something and became the leading money winner on the PGA Tour. Right after that, it took him five swings. So sometimes things that are complicated that can be made simple and attainable can be very effective and be life impacting or game impacting in this point. I've tried to break it down in my way even more functional because I'm more of a behaviorist. I'm a believer that the vector putting was the behavior side of it was easier to apply while I was playing golf. And that's what I think you got out of that 30 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it helped you. And I hope when I show people what I do in a small clinic or show them as an aside in 30 minutes, one-on-one or whatever, they walk away and they have some similar profound experiences like you did. I've been a pretty good putter most of my life. I say fortunate in that most fortunate behavior is, Raymond Berry was a famous, wide receiver. And I think one of his quotes was, when opportunity meets preparation, that's the true definition of luck. So I say I'm fortunate in the fact that I worked really hard as a youngster and throughout my golf career to spend more time on the putting green or a lot of time around the green and the putting green. And so maybe my good fortune was a little bit of effort on my part. And it's usually the case, you have to work pretty hard. But I didn't know what I was doing. I was fortunate to be around. I thought that it was all about mechanics, but it was a culmination of the people that I was associated with in my life that were good players, and watching what they do and sort of picking up on their behavior and the things that they do were really important, as important as the mechanics. Because really, and as I showed you, mechanics are all about one simple fact. And if you're doing that, then your mechanics are adequate. I'm not going to say they're the best, but they're adequate, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But if you're performing a simple function of geometry and physics, and we can see what happens in the golf ball, then you're on the right track mechanically. So I think mechanics can be a little overtaught when it comes to putting, but what is undertaught is the behavior that is involved in becoming very proficient at putting.
Now you really got me. I want to get into this behavior part. What did you witness? What did you see? Because you and I we chatted for over an hour before we started recording, and you were telling me stories about when you were caddying as a kid and you would count the posts on the metal fence, and you would know exactly what your distance was based on where the ball was near that fence. I mean, so
right.
You were figuring things out early, but what were the behavioral things that you were noticing that made an impact?
Well, I noticed that better putters practiced more, and not necessarily at a long time, but they had a routine that they followed. So that
a practice routine or a pre-shot routine?
A practice routine.
Okay.
And so that they would usually practice before they played on the putting green, and they'd spend a few minutes after the round on the putting green.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that important?
Well, I think that at a certain level there is a mind-body connection to what you're trying to do, and we realize that all putting surfaces aren't the same. And so there's a variety of reasons. Like when I played professionally overseas or when I was playing on tour, that was a common behavior among the guys that were scoring lower. I go, oh, okay. That's what I've always done, but why? One of the things is we would, when I was, say, playing in Canada, for example, we would play 1 week, say, in Sorel outside of Quebec, and the greens would be, you'd have eight different speeds on 16, you know, 18 different greens.
Really?
Yeah. You know, just it's just the way the green.
How's that possible?
Yeah, I would like to know that too. I would try to figure this out. Maybe greens were watered differently on certain holes, or maybe the grass would grow at, you know, grain was growing differently on certain holes.
I used to ask all the time. So if I'm going to practice on the putting green, is this pretty much representative of what the rest of the course is?
Keep in mind, I'm in a provincial area of Canada that's not necessarily standardized.
We mow the grass with the same equipment, and we water the same way, and it's all maintained.
Right.
So, yeah, of course it can be the same. But
I think as a standard, and we're talking early 80s here now, mid-80s, and I played in Africa too. And you'd think that, but in more provincial areas where, you know, maybe the mowers weren't set at the right place, all mowers aren't set at the right, you know, so one guy in the front nine, he's doing six holes, another guy doing those six holes, they may not quite be set the same way, and you know, maybe they have different growing conditions on different greens with less shade and more shade, and so now, and I, you know, I spent a long time in my other part of my life working with superintendents in the yardage business, the golf course measurement and graphic business, and I learned that...
All right, now you're going to make me do this. Give it a brief, you got to share with people what it is briefly, because they know who you are.
Okay.
But they don't know who you are.
Okay. Well, I was playing professional golf in the early 80s, and I was very good early at taking notes at playing. I didn't hit it as far. I didn't do a lot of things. But I felt that being organized, even though I wasn't, my brothers were better Boy Scouts than me, but I felt that being prepared was a big part of the equation. I was a John Wooden fan. Growing up, being a UCLA guy, again, the behavior aspect is huge. Mm-hmm.
And this is all pre-GPS.
Pre-GPS. And, you know, in my day growing up, it was pretty much, you know, a cypress tree at 150.
Okay.
Or a plaque in the fairway, maybe.
And so what did you do? Come on, just cut to this, because I want to get back to the conversation.
What happened was I started making yardage books. And then for my other mini tour players to support myself while I was playing mini tours. And out of that, became one of the common denominators, which is legal in the rules of golf, is a sprinkler head is a static point. So it's okay that everybody knows what that number is. It's not a secret. So you and I can talk about the yardage from that sprinkler head.
Okay.
I may not ask you what club you hit because that's
completely different.
Completely different. But we can, things that are common knowledge, like a tree or a rock or a sprinkler head. And so what happened in the early days, and this goes back a little bit, but in the early days of yardage, there was a caddy for Jack Nicklaus, who actually I think started caddying for Palmer first, but he was good at graphics. His name was Gorgeous George. He had a graphic background. And he started making yardage books for tour players. And those were pretty common when I first started playing in the early 80s as a professional. But he took a lot of yardages from sprinkler heads. What pros would do later, they'd go out and they'd get nameplates and they'd drill them or screw them onto these sprinkler heads for yardage. And when I came along in the mid-80s looking to make doing yardage books, the company at the time was very big in golf, started PGA West, some other facilities called Landmark Land Company, asked me to do a yardage book for the tour finals in 1987. And I was doing this yardage book, and he said, oh, by the way, and this is at PGA West, all my little riveted tags have fallen off my sprinkler head. Can you help me out? And I, at that point, any sort of money coming my way was a bonus. And so I said, okay, I'll figure something out. And at that point, I started figuring out sprinkler markers and how to attach them to sprinkler heads. And so the issues are being cost efficient, being visible, and can they last? And, so I did that. And quickly that led into a business which I just sold after 26 years called Grunguide, manufacturing sprinkler markers for golf courses.
Awesome.
Okay. So briefly, I've measured golf courses for years and years and years using a variety of different ways of doing it, laser technology, GPS, and all sorts of things. And so I've been involved in the irrigation and the maintenance and with superintendents. So my discussions with superintendents about greens, maintenance, and that thing has always fascinated me. And has led, and I've always taught during this time too, pretty much. So I've always coached.
All right, so I want to get back to the behavior part.
Yeah, right.
But before we do, I need to break.
Okay.
For a slight commercial here.
Okay.
Because the wonderful folks over at Audible want our listeners to know that this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible would like to provide the Golf Smarter audience an opportunity to try Audible for free and to get the audiobook of their choice from their huge library of anything they want. They can go for the first one for free. Now, John, you've been reading lately. You got a book you want to recommend to us?
Yeah, the little book, I think it's of habits. It's by Daniel, is it Coyle?
Coyle.
Yeah, Coyle.
Daniel Coyle. Oh, The Little Book of Talent.
The Little Book of Talent.
Subtitled 52 Tips for Improving Your Skills.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And I found that to be really helpful, not only for me, but you know, I like to read books that have a little bit of inspiration to them a lot, because golf beats us up a lot. You know, really the best golfers in the world, if you ask them how they play today and they say any good shots, maybe 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And so we're always, you know, functional is big in golf, being hitting shots that are functional. Opportunities, I call green light shots in golf, where we hit them, they're everything, all the systems go for me. It's right there. It's in my wheelhouse. I like the distance. I like everything. They don't come along that often. So we're obviously kind of, we try to take the negative, we're obviously dealing with a lot of negative in golf and trying to make it into positive. And so, and we tend to beat ourselves up at golf. So when I can find and so when I can find a book that is encouraging and uplifting and helps build better behavior and is inspiring, this book does that.
Perfect. It's called The Little Book of Talent, 52 Tips for Improving Your Skills, written by Daniel Coyle, and it's narrated by Grover Gardner. Interesting line it says here on the website about it. Daniel Coyle spent the last few years traveling around the world and meeting with top coaches, teachers, and neurologists in order to unlock the secret of how greatness happens, right? So he's taken this research, boiled it down to the essential 52 simple, proven rules for developing and growing talent in sports, art, music, business, or just about anything. So that is a great recommendation, especially for golfers.
Yeah.
Why not? You can definitely use it. So if you want that to be your free audiobook, go right ahead. Sign up today. All you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. Audible is AUDIBLE. audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. And we thank them very much for their support of this podcast. All right, John, behavior. Let's get back to it.
Yeah. So ultimately, you know, my background has been about a lot about things that are maybe not so obvious to golfers. And a lot of my time was spent in the presence of some really great golfers. And I was fortunate to have just enough game to kind of be let in the room, so to speak. maybe not long enough time, but enough time that I can still call friends and acquaintances, guys that are still playing professionally and women still playing professionally. I had a coaching stint in college at my alma mater, UCLA, and that experience, I did some other, I'm fortunate too in that I grew up in Southern California, or just California in general, which is sort of was in, especially as a younger man, it's probably still today, there was a lot of really talented people at teaching that had some wonderful successful experience at golf. So, you know, one of my first lessons was from Jerry Barber, and to say it at 14, and this is in the early 70s, this man was only say 10 or so years away from being a leading money winner on the PGA, maybe a Varden Trophy winner on the PGA Tour, multiple winner on the PGA Tour, winner of a major on the PGA Tour, and to be able to call him up and say, "Hey, Mr. Barber, can you give me a golf lesson?" Or to go to Little Poison, Paul Runyon. I took several lessons from Mr. Runyon, another short game specialist guy, although he taught the long game too. And he produced, there's a lot of great guys that were had a relationship. So I had this experience of being with people that not only walked the walk, but talked the talk. They did what they preached. They experienced it firsthand at a high level. And I sought them out. Just because that's the way I was, you know, and maybe to my detriment sometimes, but because you can't do everything. But I look back on it now and it was, I think it was worth my while.
Right. So now how does that bring us back to vector putting and what you've learned?
Vector putting,
I want you to teach us vector
because,
putting.
Because, I first came across Aimpoint through some very smart people and watched some guys on tour performing it, mostly the caddies. In the beginning, it seemed like Aimpoint was the pros would be just they would know just enough to be dangerous, but their caddies were a little better. which is okay. When you have that relationship with a caddy and you trust and everything else. But I took some time looking at the aim point, and I found it for myself to be a little bit more complicated than I wanted to deal with.
Interesting.
I didn't find it to be insufficient. I just found it to be a little bit more complicated. And I was approached by a gentleman that was involved in vector punting, went to a seminar, and I found the similarities quite
striking.
Yeah. But I found
And I appreciate how gracious you're being about not saying anything negative about Aimpoint, but don't worry about it.
I don't think there is. I really don't think there's anything negative about Aimpoint, as I don't think there's anything negative about vector greening. I just find, as a coach, as an instructor, I can get the essentials of my experience of how to become more efficient and more effective at performance through vector.
Okay.
And that's what appealed to me. After I went to the seminar, I found, wait a minute, and this started to ruminate within me, like, okay, what did I experience here? What just happened? Wait a minute. And then one day I was asked to give a clinic, and I go, how do I do this? And that's what I came up with, STAG, which was my acronym for basically helping people get better at golf through my clinic or through basic instructing. And the overview applies to everybody. The actual application in certain areas will be more applicable to others. Some people, STAG is more of is as much about behavior and vector green reading as, but it's about different behaviors that are involved in becoming sufficient at the actual application of putting. Now, practicing, it also works too, because it gives you a behavioral background in which to, how do I work on my putting on a daily basis? And some days, certain applications of STAG may be more important than others, but they all apply, and they're all basically, four basic areas of putting that are essential to becoming a better putter.
Is that what STAG is?
Because yeah, that's what I showed you.
I'm guessing that STAG is an acronym.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it stands for?
Speed, 2 feet and straight, aim, and green reading.
Okay. So let's speed, 2 feet.
2 feet and straight.
And straight. Okay. And then aim and green reading.
Right.
All right. Let's start at speed. I'm going to break this down.
Yeah, great. And so speed really is, and it's funny. I was always a pretty effective putter, but I've sometimes surprisingly at longer distance struggled with my speed.
Yeah. Everyone does.
I was fortunate to spend some time, and still do. I can call him an acquaintance, maybe even a friend, a guy named Dr. Craig Farnsworth.
Mm-hmm.
He's an optometrist that teaches putting instructing. And if you ever get
he's an Aimpoint instructor.
And he's an Aimpoint instructor, but he's also a very smart man, and he's an optometrist
down at the Palms,
right? One of my main approaches to every lesson, and I almost, especially with almost every student, I tell them right up front, I said, the quality of relationship you build to your target is almost always directly proportionate to the quality of golf shot you hit.
Say that again.
The quality of the relationship you develop to your target is almost always proportionate to the quality of golf shot you're going to hit.
Okay. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, it has a little bit of my background as a golf guy that mm-hmm. measured golf courses,
mm-hmm.
but it's also a little bit of what I found that I did to become a better player. Like I said, as a kid, I measured the posts that were located along the fairways and what the distance was between each post. And I could tell after a while that if things were level if I could see a post at that distance and look at the post left of me, that decrease in distance going away from me measured 100 yards, 180 yards, 200 yards. And I could count the post and say, oh, that is 200 yards. And so I'm building myself a better relationship when I notice where the pin is in the green and what the colors of the trees are around the green and where that bunker is. Like, there's some great course designers that try to trick you a little bit. They'll put bunkers, say, 30, 40 yards in front of the green. And so when you look at the flag, you see just the top of it, and you think, oh, that green's way far away from me. Or that green's just over the bunker, right? But it's really not. It's an extra 40 yards.
Yeah, we were talking about that. We were talking about the course Peacock Gap
right
here in Marin County. And on number, 10, 11, 12, the par 5, mm-hmm. there are these bunkers that are kind of blocking the green.
Mm-hmm.
And but it looks like it's, you know, because you're it's right. a par 5, you're coming in right. a long approach shot. But what you don't realize is there's probably 15 to 20 yeah. yards between the bunker and the green, and that's very deceptive.
Yeah, there's a famous golf architect, I think it was A.W. Tillinghast. Tillinghast.
Okay.
I think it's A.W., but I could be wrong on that.
I'll
but
look it
Mr.
Up
Tillinghast designed several golf courses, and a lot of them are some tremendous golf courses. He grew up in, I think, a part of Scotland, and he was the greenskeeper originally at a very famous course. I think it was, I don't think it's Royal County Down, and, but anyway.
Yeah, well, it is A.W. Tillinghast.
Okay. He's very famous for putting these bunkers out in front mm-hmm. of greens. And so this visual perception, in my opinion, really enhances your ability to hit a good golf shot. Mm-hmm. Because our brain is an amazing effective machine.
Speak for yourself.
Okay, exactly. And but when we try to override it, we sometimes get in the way.
Golf is notorious for that.
Correct. So when I build that better relationship to the target, I'm programming my brain in a way to act in a more efficient way.
So familiarity of the golf course is key to this.
Well, not only familiarity, but familiarity with the moment.
Explain that.
Well, you know, I may have driven, you know, you may have played your home course 100 times, 200 times, 300 times. But all of a sudden you're faced with a golf shot, and the golf shot requires not the familiarity of the whole golf course shot, but the whole golf course, but that golf shot. Yep. So in this moment, what am I capable of doing? What, you know, when you break it down into every golf shot has an essential, like, there's several elements. What are the actual elements of this shot? The pragmatic issues like distance, like uphill, downhill. And those things are very straightforward. But the things that aren't so obvious is how do I get my body to adapt to this moment to hit this golf shot? And how do I get more in tune with what the actual yardage is? Is it slightly uphill? Is it slightly downhill? Do I really know that? Do I feel that? Am I sensing that? Am I programming that into this shot? And if I can really see that and feel that in a more real way, like I see that, like, for example, some flags are higher than others. You know, most flags run about 7 feet, I think, but some courses they might be a little different. So we're tricked, right? We're tricked. If I have more efficient information on how to make my shot, you know, then I'm, like you mentioned, oh, if he would just give me the pin placement on that green, then I can hit a better shot, you know? So that helps me make a better decision about what my shot, because when I'm a golf pro and my caddy and I are standing there looking at our yardage book, we're looking at numbers saying the first thing we do is get rid of the worst shot. So what club or what shot approach here, what approach to the shot eliminates the highest penalty for failure? Because it's not about how many great shots I hit in a round of golf. It's more about efficient shots. So, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if I have good information, which is a good yardage, and I can feel that and apply that to the moment, then I'm more efficient at producing what I need to do in that moment. It's not a question of knowing where the course is and I like that area, but and if I do that effectively time and time again, I get better results. Which brings us back to the stag. And that's what speed is a good way of that. If I can understand the speed of this green, if I understand the speed of this green in particular, which generally today is pretty similar with all golf courses, but, you know, where am I, uphill or am I downhill? Am I on a side hill? You know, do I have grain working against me? What's my friction going to be? You know,
wind.
Wind can be a factor sometimes. Usually pretty strong wind to do that, but yeah, it can be a factor. Subtle winds can just be a factor in my stability to hit the putt.
Time of the day, because the condition of the green is radically different than
right.
it was
and
first
especially,
thing in the morning.
Especially on Bermuda greens where you have grain, you know, later in the afternoon, you got a little more grain than you maybe had in the morning. Big factor, right? Wow. And so all these things are important in the speed and the friction. So speed is one of those things of building a better relationship to the target. And stag in itself is just building that better relationship to the target and how I do that.
Okay, so we've gotten through the S in stag. We've got tag left, but we're out of time. So what we're going to do, can you stick around?
Sure.
Okay, so we're going to do a members-only episode. We'll pick it up at T
okay.
for Stag, and we'll talk in more depth, and I'm going to pick it apart as best I can with you, and we'll do the rest there. So I please advise the audience, you know, this is what Golf Smarter for Members Only is all about. If you want to get part two of so many of these conversations where we really get into a lot of the meat, because, you know, after I get to know the guy, I got to ask a lot of more questions. So, and it won't be limited by 30 minutes. If we take an hour to finish the answer, then that's what we'll do on the members only episode. So please go to Golf Smarter for Members Only and join today. It's at golfsmarter.com. Also, just to let you know, the month of June 2013 that we're recording this, we also have a Father's Day special going on. If you want a present, or you have a dad in your life that is a golfer and needs to know about the Golf Smarter podcast, right now you can get a year's membership for only $15, and usually it's just $15 to get in the door. So take advantage of that. Go to golfsmarter.com, sign up for the Father's Day special. And we will continue the conversation with John Grun on the upcoming episode. John, I appreciate you doing this. Again, next episode is for members only. So when you check your podcast app for the hour-long part two of this conversation, don't be confused, because you will see the title and the contents, but you won't find the audio file. But you can get that feed and access to our entire archives and all those conversations that go into more depth with part two when you join Golf Smarter for Members Only and help continue this listener-supported podcast. And if you're a member or not, or a dad or not, happy Father's Day and enjoy the U.S. Open. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.